Water is life. Land is our first teacher. Many Indigenous people hold these truths to be self-evident. But no matter our ethnicity or culture, we feel the significance of water throughout our lives. Its presence, its absence, even its excess.
And first here at 6:30, extreme flooding in eastern Oregon. Governor Brown has declared a state of emergency in three counties as the overflowing Umatilla River flooded roads and homes, trapped cars, and shut down schools.
The Umatilla River has several names. Imatalamwana in the Sahaptan language, Hiawatalam in the language of the Namipu or Nez Perce people. Many Sahaptan-speaking peoples have deep relationships with the river, the Wailetpu, or Cayuse, the Walulapam, or Walla Walla, and Imatalamshama, the Umatilla people, who share their name with the river. When the flooding happened in February 2020, we saw the power of the river and the water. Heavy rainfall and rapidly melting snowpack at the headwaters in the Blue Mountains dramatically increased the river's water level, threatening alfalfa fields, cattle pasture, several homes, all culturally and historically significant places. This story is about one of those. As you travel west from the Umatilla's headwaters, you move through an area named for aspen trees and springs surrounding the river, Nikyawi. It encompasses the places now known as Pendleton, Oregon, and the Umatilla Indian Reservation. As you follow the river's gradual turn northward, you pass Pishkuiipa, the place that has rabbit brush, where jackrabbit hunting was popular in the early 20th century. Continuing north, you come to a place called Kupa, or Tule Place. Since time immemorial, people have gathered hard-stemmed tule bulrush reeds here. Indigenous people in the region make tule mats for many purposes, but they are most often draped over frames to form teepee and longhouse structures. In 2020, the floodwaters carved away a large chunk of the western riverbank at Kupa. The water's encroachment on the land mirrored the way foreigners encroached into the region over the course of centuries, but we'll get into that a bit later. The flood forced city officials, the Army Corps of Engineers, the state of Oregon, and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation to take collective action. Their goals were to stop the erosion and prevent future flooding from causing even more damage. Since the preservation of the Kupa site had already been compromised, they hired archaeologists to evaluate the situation and reanalyze artifacts from previous excavations. That's where I come in. My name is Megan Caves. I'm a researcher at the University of Idaho, and I study historical archaeology. My job is to take information from many different sources and put together a story about this place we know as Kupa. I use historical artifacts, letters, journals, maps, as well as knowledge shared by elders and locals to tell the most accurate story possible. These powerful connections and memories from the past are now rising into our present, much like the floodwaters of Imatalamwana. I am grateful for the opportunity to share these connections and memories with you. Land is our first teacher. Water is life. It's important to note that this Kupa is not the only place along the Umatilla River named for the tules. It's a really popular name in the area, actually. And that's because of how abundant these tules are in the region and how important they are to the people here. The same name for different places, each existing in context with other places, people, and experiences. This place, known as Kupa, can only be fully understood in relationship. It served as a permanent camp for Umatilla people and provided a known resting place for travelers, including new ones who started moving through the region in the mid-1800s. What we now call the Oregon Trail took advantage of the travel networks developed and used by Indigenous people for millennia. In their diaries and narratives, foreigners wrote about the lower crossing of the Umatilla River as a landmark along their journey. One such entry describes the crossing as a hub where many people and purposes met. John Lawrence Johnson, August 5th, 1851.
We met a man from Oregon who had a contract to put up a building for an Indian agency. He wanted to hire a few men to help him raise the building. As he had hewed out the frame from green cottonwood and they had twisted and curled up so, it was quite a job to put the frame together. I agreed to stop 2 or 3 days and help raise the building. The boss had some goods to trade to the Indians. He hired 5 to help raise. We got the first bent up and braced. The Indians went back, sat down, and when ready to raise the second bent, refused to help. Too tired. The boss had to make a new treaty. Give each a new shirt, tobacco, coffee, sugar, some of everything he had in the store. So on. With each bent, new treaty. As it was framed in 4 bents, we got it up by sundown and was ready to resume our journey.
Johnson was paid $3 a day for those 3 days of work, but he was making much more than just $9 on his Oregon venture. The Donation Land Claim Act of 1850 granted every unmarried, white, male, U.S. citizen 320 acres of territorial land free of charge. His story about the native men who kept renegotiating their labor rates shows that they clearly understood the concept of supply and demand. Perhaps they knew that the establishment of the Utila Indian Agency in their community represented the beginnings of a different transaction, one for which no amount of shirts, tobacco, coffee, or sugar could be enough. 2 years later, the large frame house Johnson helped raise was painted white as snow. A diary entry from another Oregon Trail traveler describes more Western capitalism at the Utila Agency, this time with Elias Wampole, who was stationed there as the territorial Indian agent. Virgil Pringle, September 25th, 1853.
Here also an opportunity to procure flour. Mr. Wampole asked $18 per 100 pounds. Sugar is 37.5 cents. Coffee, ditto. A mail contractor who carries mail between the Dalles and Salt Lake City also had a trading tent, and he sold flour for $15 per 100 pounds. An Indian brought in 2 white-looking salmon to us, for which he asked $2, but found no purchasers. Most of the materials which the house has been built were brought from the late Dr. Whitman's station.
Both of those diary entries describe relatively peaceful exchanges. But throughout the area, interactions among foreigners and indigenous peoples were often marked by hostility or violence. That first boiled over in 1847, a few years after white settlers started pouring into the West. The late Dr. Whitman, who Virgil Pringle wrote about, was the Protestant missionary Marcus Whitman. The mission at Wayilepu, near present-day Walla Walla, was a landmark. Today, the place is known for what the National Park Service calls the tragedy at Wayilepu. It's a very complicated series of events, but what you really need to know for this story is that many people died, and it started what came to be known as the Cayuse War. Back at Kupa, it's important to remember that the people living there were deeply connected to the people and events at Wayilepu, and affected by the conflict that came from it. Territorial Indian agents lived at the agency on and off from autumn 1851 through 1853. Their white timber frame agency building stood out from the clusters of tule mat homes and isolated log cabins more common to the region. Oregon Trail travelers wrote about how different and comforting the sight of the building was to them. I imagine their feelings were not wholly shared by the Amatzalam Shama indigenous people. As conflicts continued, the territorial government barred trade at the Utila Indian Agency. From that point on, the Indian agent lived at the Dalles full-time, surrounded by other white settlers and the U.S. military. The so-called Cayuse War officially ended with the signing of the Treaty of June 9, 1855. Members of the Wayilepu, Walulapam, and Imatalam Shama tribes served as representatives of sovereign nations. They negotiated and signed a complex agreement with representatives of the United States. The treaty ceded 6.4 million acres to the U.S., with the condition that tribal members could still access these lands for fishing, hunting, gathering foods and medicines, and pasturing livestock. It also reserved just over 500,000 acres upriver from Kupa, where the newly formed Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation would live. The Cayuse, Walla Walla, and Umatilla people, accustomed to traveling and living throughout the Northwest, were now expected to live on a reservation smaller than the state of Rhode Island. A new Indian agency was established on the reservation to facilitate the terms of the treaty. This marked a dramatic change in the governmental policies and relationships between these groups. How this change would affect the lives of the people living at and near Kupa remained to be seen.